Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 9th of August, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We're delighted to be joined today by live video Skype link by Alex Thompson, who brings us, of course, Eastern Approaches from the Netherlands. Key question, should we trust bankers and the banking industry, Mike?
Well, never, but this is an very interesting little interview here. This is Libero, an Italian newspaper, and it's Ettore Gotti Tedeschi, who was head of the Vatican Bank from 2009 to 2012, and he's being interviewed by Paolo Becci. Well, he's got some hugely amusing things to say. He says, let's get straight onto it, in order to work, the single currency needs a single European government which must coexist with a global world government. He said, we've moved towards this at an ever faster pace since the 2007 financial crash. And that's thanks to supranational organizations that are imposing laws, various democratic models, co-opted leaders, and a homogeneous moral view is how he describes it. And then he's asked, so is it our destiny to be living under this world super government? And he said, yes. The situation makes me think we must recognize that we are impotent as people. We can no longer do anything. Games are being played. We're not no longer taking part in the games. We have become a game in the hands of others, is what he said. He went on to say this, that, for example, with the result of the EU and the euro in particular at risk as a result of Italian banks, and he's saying that to reduce the budget deficit, for example, euthanasia could be imposed on everyone over the age of 65 to cut public spending on pensions and healthcare. And as a result of the problems with the Italian banks and the implications for the euro, he said that the EU could impose expropriation of citizens' property. So this was a very interesting article, Brian.
Well, it's certainly interesting for me with a few years to go, just a few years to go until I'm 65. Alex, how is it possible for a church to be talking in this sort of language?
Oh, well, that's because the Vatican is a one-off, isn't it? It's a church and a state and a bank all rolled in together. Anyone with a memory going back to 78, well, I was born that year, but that year, I know from reading about it, Roberto Calvi, one of the Vatican bankers, was found hanging under Blackfriars Bridge in the last time that the Vatican bankers came into the news. Basically, the Vatican rakes in huge amounts of money from the donations of the faithful and from their land and other assets over the world. And this is put in a bank called the IOR, the Institute for the Operation of Religion. And that's what Signor Tedeschi was head of until he jumped before he was pushed in 2010. You can read about this in an English translation of an Italian journalistic investigation. The book's called Ratzinger Was Afraid. Ratzinger, of course, was the birth name of what became Pope Benedict. And Tedeschi had actually quite some opposition, according to that book, against others from the social justice wing of the church. So the cardinal in charge of justice and peace projects, when the social justice cardinal started proposing that there should be a global government and so on, Tedeschi said no, because, of course, his background is Northern Italian senior banker, which is how the Vatican drafts in the best talent into the Vatican. They're not all clerics who manage the Vatican's money recently. So there may be an element here of Tedeschi putting the cat among the pigeons, because he came off worst in a scuffle under the last papacy, in which he was seeing the writing on the wall and seeing that the Marxists who've thoroughly infiltrated the Vatican, particularly through Jesuitry, were gaining the upper hand. So he may be blowing the whistle and almost cynically over-egging the pudding slightly about what the Marxists in the banks want to do. That would be one line of me in analysing it. But yes, Brian, your question's very germane. How can a church which claims to be the successor of Peter be managing all these billions of pounds, euros, dinars, shekels, dollars, whatever, when this was very much contrary to what Christ told Peter to do in the Great Commission. But anyway, that's the situation we're in. I won't deny that the Vatican does a lot of good in the world, but the pots of money in the Vatican are hugely over-centralised, and something needs to be done about that.
Alex, it's interesting you mentioned Ratzinger, because Tedeschi did say in the interview that he misses Pope Benedict. He regrets that Benedict's gone. And then he was asked about immigration, and he said that if he was to discuss immigration openly, I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, that he would risk excommunication. But he said that that the scale of immigration that we're seeing is a planned operation.
That rather reconfirms to me, and even the fact that his surname means the German, because Northern Italians are of German descent, the Lombards, that suggests to me that we have a split here, and that would also explain why he's doing his big splash in a Milanese paper where they're all Germanic business types. Libero is a Milan paper, something equivalent to the Daily Mail for small business owners. So it does suggest to me that the sensible side of Italian banking has realised, hang on, we actually have a national interest here. We can't just, okay, the Vatican pays us well for our banking expertise, but now these nutty Marxists have taken over the Roman Catholic Church's money and planning. We need to get the faithful to act on it, particularly the Italians themselves.
Alex, do you really think that those bankers are thinking about national interests, or could it be that some of the smaller banks begin to see the writing on the wall for them as the big boys start to clean up?
Well, in Italy, Brian, there is actually a lesser degree of corruption in the banks. People might laugh at that because they think of Italy as a Mediterranean country and all the stereotypes. But Italian family-run banks, particularly in the area around Siena and around Milan as well, have a very German-style efficient business model where they actually have real assets and have a lot more on the books as a proportion of what they lend than British or French or Swiss or American banks do. So it is a sensible model. And most of these guys in Italian banking do regard themselves as working for the family and for the regional interest at the very least. But yes, I will accept that when they go off like Draghi and Monti and the others to work for Anglo-American concerns, especially Goldman Sachs, they end up with a very, very jaundiced view. And of course, Romano Prodi as well, who is alleged on many hands to have been a KGB agent for many years. So there's a lot of intrigue in there. But there are some very good Italian bankers, and some of them get bumped off.
Indeed. Okay. Well, that's true. Okay, well, let's move on to Brexit. And Alex, you sent me this tweet from the Foreign Office, which says we've published plans for new powers to be introduce tough sanctions against individuals, organisations and foreign governments post-Brexit. And they include a little video clip. And the headline on the video clip is, we're also adding powers to UK law to make it easier to freeze a terrorist bank account. Now, you've asked in the sort of caption here, who gives HM government its powers? Because clearly this is a very valid question when they seem to be awarding themselves powers. And this comes back to the age-old constitutional fight in this country over who has the right to decide what the power of government and which powers of governance government has, because we've had this ongoing fight for generations over the divine right of kings, which has in more recent days become the divine right of parliament. And this seems to be fairly representative of that.
I would agree with that line on it, Mike. For the Foreign and Commonwealth Office to, I know that they're managing a Twitter account here and the graphics team are taking the lead over the brains here. But for them to say we're adding powers to UK law is wrong in several respects. And for a start, the phrase UK law, which I found often used in GCHQ in the legal compliance guff, is only very tenuously acceptable. I know what they mean. They mean law enacted from Westminster, which doesn't touch upon devolved powers in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. But it's the law of England and Wales plus the law of Scotland plus the law of Northern Ireland, which almost always are in total harmony on UK-wide issues. So that's one problem with it. Powers is a much abused phrase, of course. We give our powers, which are our sovereign powers as a people, to the Crown and to agencies such as the Constabulary, which are only just a professional embodiment of the powers we all have. And if they fail, we take them back, as we've done in many times in our history. So the notion that government can award itself powers is a very confused one. And as often in Britain, we have this layer of obscurity because of the language we use. On the continent, they're well aware that there are two rights of initiative in legislation. There's Parliament and there's ministers. And in this case, we have the FCO in its ministerial role, drafting legislation for our MPs to sleepily rubber stamp later. But because we have that ministers in Parliament and the Crown in Parliament in Britain, people are confused about this and think that the government can just write its own law. No, it's from the people.
Absolutely. Now, sticking with Brexit, one of the big arguments is being ramped up at the moment is over the issue of the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. This is the New European, and they're saying the Brexit vote has created a united Ireland, at least when it comes to the border. I don't think so. But let's just have a look at one example of part of the Northern Irish border. It tends to be, in many cases, single track roads, and the only sign that you get that you've crossed the border is that the speed limit signs have changed to kilometres an hour from miles per hour. So this fight continues. They're obviously talking about creating this sea border around Britain where there would have to be customs checks and border checks at ports and airports, including ports and airports in Northern Ireland. And of course, the unionist parties in Northern Ireland aren't going to have that because they will not. In fact, the UK government is saying that they're not going to have it because they're saying that we cannot create a border between Northern Ireland and Great Britain, being the same country. So the Irish position seems to be that the border is leaky, that it's always been leaky. They can't enforce a border because there's so many streets like roads like this one on screen at the moment. But of course, that's a nonsense argument because that's the same situation in every other national border in the European Union where they don't seem to be too concerned about the fact that the border with perhaps the border with Switzerland is easier to control because it's so mountainous. But other countries, it's exactly the same case. Alex, they ignore the common travel area, which has existed between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland since the foundation, more or less, of the Republic in 1923. So I think you might agree with me. There's no reason why they couldn't create a bilateral agreement, which is separate from anything else. And of course, this is absolutely being denied by the people arguing both sides here. But we're allowed bilateral arguments, or bilateral agreements, rather, it seems, for defence issues. But we seem to be not allowed a bilateral agreement in this case. There seem to be double standards at work.
Yes, Mike, bilateral issues confuse continental countries as well. We see a lot of Dutch Conservative parties now saying we recognise that there are bilateral defence agreements with Germany, but we don't want to go beyond that to EU military unification, as if there was a choice. Now, as regards bilateral agreements, the EU is not only an international treaty organisation, but also one of a kind in the world, a supranational organisation, a government above one's nation state. And one of the consequences of that is it doesn't like the existence of bilateral treaties and agreements and zones among and between its member states and bordering countries. Sweden and Norway, for example. Norway has whacked a huge tariff on dairy products imports. So there's a lot of illegal Swedish butter import into Norway because that's cheaper on the black market, something analogous to how the South Armagh sheep farmers on tracks like that used to import diesel when it was much cheaper on the Irish Republic side of the border. This is a matter for collaboration between police and customs and just good old common sense. But we don't hear the Swedes and Norwegians threatened like this, even though the Swedes are getting cold feet in some ways about EU membership. So it's a scam. It's the EU pretending that once you're in the EU, you have no ability to negotiate anything. And the other angle of this, for which people should read the latest Peter Hitchens blog at the Mail on Sunday, is that Leo Varadkar, the very young, I think he's just my age, just under 40, the new Taoiseach or Irish Republic Prime Minister, is a very bullying character. It was inevitable that he would replace the failed former Taoiseach, who was mired in scandals, because he was his protege. And all the noise has been about the fact that he's all for homosexual rights, is homosexual himself and is young and Asian, and this is an overthrowing of the old Irish Conservative Catholic order, we're told. But what more significant is that he washes up in Belfast and tells the Northern Irish people it's time to leave the United Kingdom and stay in the European Union, and also interferes with their policies on abortion and marriage. So this is a very queer situation, no pun intended. And as Mr. Hitchin says, how would we like it, or how would the Irish Republic like it, if we sent the Prime Minister to Dublin to bash their ears about their bilateral agreements?
Absolutely. Well, in the meantime, I'm just only putting this in for a bit of a laugh, Brian, but this is the Irish Independent, and the headline is Irish MEP says UK not brave enough to hold a second Brexit referendum. And of course, as many people on Twitter and so on have pointed out, Ireland absolutely brave enough to ignore democracy and hold as many referendums as it takes in order to get the right answer.
Yes.
Yes, no more to say on that. And Alex, we'll move on to end this section on Brexit on this one. The European arrest warrant. This is a House of Lords report, the sixth report of session 2017 to 2019. And the title is Brexit, Judicial Oversight of the European Arrest Warrant. And you've captioned it here, is what is unacceptable to their lordships actually that British subjects should stop being extraditable to the continent for pseudo-crimes such as xenophobia? So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the report you see is from one of the committees of the House of Lords. There are several committees dealing with the EU, and this one in particular looks at the ramifications of EU agreements on domestic law in Britain. And they took evidence, as they call it, basically a propaganda session from a retired judge. You'll see him named in section 16 if you look up that PDF. And again, the details of his evidence later on, paragraphs 22 and following. Sir Francis, someone who was the Chief Justice, a British man, of course, and the Chief Justice of the Court of Justice of the European Union for a while. And unsurprisingly, he's saying it will be terrible if we leave the remit of the Court of Justice of the European Union because we won't be able to get wanted criminals back from the continent. You know, as if that was a problem before the European Union arrest warrant came along. And at the root of this, of course, is that there are 14 crimes initially identified as in the Corpus Juris Project as early as the early 90s when this was first warned about. Torquil Dick Erickson and others, a barrister based in Rome, warned about this. And this list of 14 crimes, which are so heinous you have to be tracked down and sent to other European Union countries, include two at the bottom of the list which are not crimes in English or Scots law, the crimes of racism and xenophobia. So, you know, this is presented as if, you know, we'll suddenly be losing track of continental criminals if we have one day outside the purview of the Court of Justice of the European Union. But as I was raising there in the question, is it more the case that we won't, what our establishment don't want to see is that there will be one day on which our people can speak freely without the threat of being sent off to Greece to be tried for xenophobia?
So this again seems to be Brian implying there seems to be a thread through all this that we have forgotten the arrangements that were in place before we joined the European Union, and there's the assumption that we can't go back to some similar type of arrangement.
I think it's really that the country didn't function at all originally. We didn't really have a country. We didn't know who we were. We couldn't really manufacture anything. It was only when we got in the European Union that we were able to just about cope. Mm. It's fantastic. I've got to say, it's a while since I've seen that excellent word xenophobia, because I remember never seeing it, and then suddenly it became the in word that everybody was xenophobic or racist or something. And that was pushed through, and then suddenly it seems to have faded away again, because, of course, it, as you've said in the slide, it's part of the pseudo-crime. Agenda. Well, if we're talking Brexit, we've got to be talking Brexit light. And of course, that means Brexit with no exit. And we better bring on Theresa May. And I wanted to follow up on yesterday's news where we were starting to dig in who has been advising this lady. And we focused on this guy, Nick Timothy. And I'd like to thank our viewers who took the trouble to do some research during and after the programme, because it's fascinating how this has gone. So if we just recap a little bit, this gentleman was not only advising Theresa May, but he was there getting involved with Policy Exchange, which was itself a creation of the Tory party, Francis Maud. He's been busy with the New Schools Network. Now, this is a mixture of money and people who want to make sure that Britain's children have the best education. We focused on this lady, Diana Berry. We'll come back to her in a minute. But this was the charity that people flagged up. It's called Action Against Abduction. And this is one of these wonderful websites, Mike, where you get confidence the moment you see it. It's all about the immense good work that's being done to protect children from abduction, principally by their own families, but possibly by strangers. But no mention of at all, of course, of the abduction of children by social services, for example. But the charity itself linked into Rescue Alert, and they make quite a big issue of the fact that they're supporting these two charities, so Child Rescue Alert and Missing Kids. And if we follow through Missing Kids, this was very interesting. It says, help us find Britain's missing children. And then in red underneath, it says, in the UK, a child is reported missing every 3 minutes. Now, somebody might like to check my mathematics on this, but I think that means that about 175,000 children go missing a year. I did that very quickly, so I might have got it wrong. We've got it linked into the National Crime Agency, CEOPS, Pact and Missing People. And this lady had originally set up the Action Against Abduction, Lady Catherine Meyer. She'd had a problem with her German husband. He took the children away. She didn't see them for a long time. So she wrote a book and then set up this organisation. She receives, I think it was the MBE for her good work. But what I found fascinating is from both sides of these organisations, we've got immensely powerful women who are raising huge amounts of money for the Conservative Party. So we've got a mixture of political policy, very powerful banking interests, together with people who are standing up and more or less boasting about the good work they're doing to protect children. But of course, the elephant in the room remains Conservative Whip Tim Fortescue, who said that Tory MPs were coming to the whips in order to get protection because they'd done something wrong, including with small boys. But none of these people want to talk about Tim Fortescue or the fact he said we had paedophiles operating inside the Tory party. So if anybody would like to assist with some further research into these organisations, we think that would be good value. But let's link into the National Crime Agency. They've got an interesting article about a gentleman who's been convicted for something to do with child-like sex dolls. We've got CEOPS, which is all part of the network the government's put together supposedly to protect children. They recommend Childline, which is very interesting. But down at the bottom of the website, the bottom left-hand corner of your page, it had this to say, which I found very interesting, that the National Crime Agency is not subject to the provisions of the Freedom of Information Act 2000. Not sure why that is, so we've emailed them to say, how is it that you are immune from that act? But if we come back to the statistics of a child goes missing every 3 minutes, if we start to look at these other websites, only 280 children are posted missing. And they don't include the 350 missing Syrian children, Mike. So my question to the audience today is really, why do these statistics not add up? And if we put this view on screen, this is part of that Missing Kids website. So when you look at the number of children missing, 280, so that's the top three. So this is, where are we? August the 6th, August the 7th of this year. If we go back to look at the oldest, we're going back to December 1959, Mike. Yeah. So one child every 3 minutes, somebody's checked the calculation, is 175,200 children per year. The figure we believe that the National Police Chiefs Council has said is 30,000. But according to the government's charities and the National Crime Agency, it's a mere 280 over the period back to 1959.
Well, this is nonsense, as you're hinting at here, Brian, because even the most optimistic statements from the likes of the National Crime Agency and Missing Children and so on imply a significantly larger proportion of that 175,200 children per year disappear. You know, most of those children come back or are found.
Two-thirds come back, yes.
You know, even the most optimistic statistic for the number that come back implies significantly more than a couple of hundred children.
So I find it remarkable that we've got senior and very capable Tory policymakers like Mr. Nick Timothy working with these charities, but they can't get their figures right about exactly how many children are missing. And it's not just the charities, because they're linked into the National Crime Agency, which links us back into the Metropolitan Police in particular. Mm. So I believe that there's something very strange going on here. I can't really pin it down. I don't get a comfortable feel for the Tory party, big banking money for the Tory party and the protection of children. So if there's anybody who would like to do a little bit of research in that direction, we'd be very grateful.
Okay, just a quick reminder that Friday will be the last news before we go on holiday. We're off from the 14th until the 30th of August. And of course, because the monthly meeting falls in that period, unfortunately, there won't be a monthly meeting in August. So please don't come to that one. The next monthly meeting will be the third Wednesday, the evening of the third Wednesday of September. And second little advertisement here, Alex and Alcee Giazzese and Patrick Henningsen and I produced an episode of Insight last night or yesterday afternoon on the issue of what the future of the Balkans might be. So one point of view might be, if you go and have a look at this World Economic Forum article here, which is what Montenegro's NATO membership means for the Balkans and the alliance. But if you wait until tomorrow, for members only on the UK column membership website, we'll have that issue of Insight discussing the Balkans. It was Alex, it was an interesting discussion.
It certainly was, Mike, and we really regarded this as an initial scene setting of where the Balkans is at now. And if this goes well, we hope later to produce a follow-up where we zoom out and go back in time and consider the grander narratives. But with a complicated part of the world, you have to start with the things happening now. I felt that you, Pat, and above all, of course, Alcee, were very good at adding in the points of view which help our viewers understand just what's going on in the Balkans, which has never really been a part of the world allowed to follow its own interests. I think it's worth saying for newer members who've subscribed, of whom there's quite a few, if I'm not wrong, Mike, people can best log in and then go to members' forums in order to find Insight. Is that correct?
Members' blogs. Members' blog. I always
members'
post
blogs,
it in the,
that's right.
Always posted in the members' blog section. Okay, now let's move on to this. Ineos, the fracking company, the company which is taking part in fracking, at least because it's a lot bigger than just its fracking interests, has managed to get hold of a High Court injunction, which applies nationally, it seems, which is acting against anti-fracking protesters. So they've put this big warning on their website. Warning, High Court injunction in force, notice and service of order to persons unknown, brackets the defendants, from Innocence Ineos Upstream Limited. If you, the within named defendants, of course they're unknown, but if you, the within named defendants, or any of you disobey this order, you will be held in contempt of court and may be imprisoned, fined, or have your assets seized. Any other person who knows of this order and does anything which helps or permits the defendants or any of them to breach the terms of this order may also be held to be in contempt of court and may be imprisoned, fined, or have his or her assets seized. You should read the terms of the order very carefully. You're advised to consult a solicitor as soon as possible. This order was made at a hearing without notice to the defendants, who have the right to apply to the court to vary or discharge the order as set out below. And in fact, that's exactly what's going to happen, because Ian Crane will be working with a legal team to try to get this order set aside. And we'll come on to the implications of this in a second. They also say you may be liable to pay the claimant's costs of the proceedings and damages if you unsuccessfully contest the order and or breach the terms of this order. So in other words, at your own risk, you may end up with significant court costs if you attempt to challenge this in any way. The injunction prohibits the defendants from pursuing any course of conduct against the claimants and or third parties, such as amounts to harassment. Okay, that's fair enough. The defendants and each of them from combining together to commit any of the following offences or unlawful acts, pursuing any course of conduct such as amounts to intimidation or annoyance of by violence or otherwise amounts to an offence under blah, 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 pursuing any course of conduct that amounts to criminal damage or theft, obstructing free passage along the highway. Now, this is the important part, because the other two, you know, it's against the law to commit any kind of unlawful act, of course, and it's Harassment, of course, is against the law as well. So those two things, there's not even any point in having them in that injunction. But this business of obstructing the free passage along a highway, because the guidance from Parliament is as follows. The right to freedom of assembly encompasses participation in private and public meetings, processions, mass actions, demonstrations, pickets and rallies. It does not include participation in violent protests, but includes, for example, a sit-down protest on a public road, even though traffic is disrupted as a result. To determine whether a demonstration is peaceful, the courts will look at the intention of the organisers. So what has to be said here, Brian and Alex, is that the intention of the protectors at the camps and at the protests is peaceful. It's always peaceful. And they normally carry out sit-down protests, or they walk slowly along the road, obstructing the trucks and the various material that's being brought to the site. But the sit-down protests are absolutely permitted according to the parliamentary guidance, even where traffic is disrupted. The INEOS injunction appears to imply that that parliamentary position is now being overridden by the injunction, and therefore the common law position is infringed. So that absolutely has to be challenged. Extremely dangerous.
Well, it's very dangerous because if it stands as a precedent case, it means that any corporate interest can simply use the law to stop any form of legitimate protest against what it's doing. But the other point is that, of course, the law firm that took the case forward for INEOS has not advised them on what the law of the country properly is, because you've stated what it is, that you can obstruct a highway and that's not a problem. So this has been taken to court and the injunction obtained fraudulently under the law, in my opinion.
Yeah, Alex, what are your thoughts?
Lawyers training is at the root of this ill. Since 1969, law schools haven't taught the Constitution. There's an increasing trend for barristers, so that's advocates for those in the US model, about barristers from other Commonwealth countries to appear and be double accredited in London, and solicitors too, for the law of England and Wales. And that's especially useful when it's an Australian or Canadian mining company, as seem to specialise in pillaging the country these days. Now, they'll have been given, they're giving their clients their expensive guidance based on the letter of statute law. But as John Hurst never tires of telling us with the case of Hansard, and also Dr. John Coleman always used to say with regard to the congressional record, if you want to discover the will of Parliament in a common law jurisdiction, you look at the text of the bill, its header, and particularly the debates around the issues which the members had at the time when they were framing their legislation and guidance issued afterwards. Now, as regards sit-down protests, I'm never aware of any previous case in the whole of what's usually called mainland Britain, England, Wales and Scotland, of a sit-down protest ever having been disrupted by the police or private agents. There were a few on the Lower Ormo Road in Belfast in the late stages of the Troubles, but that was not an analogy. That was the RUC broke them up because it was a sit-down protest blocking a parade. So that's protest thwarting protest, which is a different kettle of fish. You know, it's not parity anymore. But protesters stopping business or disrupting business lawfully and peacefully is very much provided for under common law. But I'm afraid the expensive lawyers who've been hired in are probably thinking in either EU continental Napoleonic legal terms, or at the very best, they're thinking in terms of get the letter of the law. And they're not well... they're not turning to well-seasoned and honest lawyers who know the whole of the English legal tradition.
Just before we move on from this, Brian, what's interesting is that the police have said that they are not going to enforce this injunction. So the police themselves do not want to get involved in this argument. So what that will leave is a situation where INEOS would be taking video evidence from any future protest and then attempting to take that through the civil courts with view to seizing people's property. And I guess what they're aiming for here is to put people off from protesting if they could get a couple of high profile cases where maybe even a home was taken as a result of this.
Yeah.
So Yeah.
Well, we know part of the problem with the fracking, the response to the fracking demonstrations has been the police. And I'm going to jump to Devon and Cornwall police. Several people have reported about this particular article. Video shows what 140 miles an hour looks like from inside a police BMW. And this is a little video that was tweeted out by Devon and Cornwall policemen. It's caused some response. So even the Telegraph has picked it up here. Police officer dubbed King of Selfies defends posting 140 mile an hour motorway video on the way to scrapyard theft. Now, the first thing I'm going to put in there is, but there was no crime. We'll come on to that in a minute. This was part of that video. And what you're looking at there, bottom right, is a picture of the speedo and the taco for the vehicle. And you can see that this vehicle is virtually being driven flat out. So this is the sort of speed that can damage the engine of this vehicle. And of course, it's public property being hammered here. So we've got 140 mile an hour by Sergeant Tangy at night for a scrapyard break-in, but there was no crime.
The other point to make here, Brian, of course, is it wasn't a motorway, it was the A38. And this is one of the worst accident roads that I've ever come across.
That is correct. Night and excessive speed, but ultimately the scrapyard was the owner's son and one of his friends. So what was the justification for driving at this speed? Have they hit anybody? Well, of course, they would have been killed. So you ask yourself, what sort of policeman is this man? Well, you only have to go to his Twitter page to see. So what have we got across the top? Well, we've got the back of a policeman holding an automatic weapon, and we've got the immature grinning face of Sergeant Harry Tangy. This is a dangerous individual. Many people have said to us that they regard this man as being dangerous. And the minimum we could say is that if you have a look at his Twitter page, most of his working time seems to be tweeting out.
Right.
So encourage people to go and have a look at it. This, of course, would be one of the policemen who's going to be additionally armed with the new tasers because he's part of the firearms unit. So we'll just leave you to think about that. Is that man acting in his normal frame of mind? Well, it's possible, but it would also be interesting to know whether he's been significantly trained and indeed reframed by one of the many training agencies now working with Britain's police.
What's next? Right. Alex, here's the question. Who owns London? Who owns our capital city? In fact, this perhaps applies to many cities across the country.
It does indeed. And one of the first I knew about was Luton, the nearest big town to me, where my father used to go and do some street preaching outside the Arndale Centre, the shopping centre in the middle of Luton. And as early as 20 years ago, certainly 15, he got these kinds of private security guards coming up to him and saying, well, they didn't tell the whole story, but as it turned out, the council had done a quick and dirty deal to sell the land, so it was no longer municipal land, that's ours, and it was instead owned by a private company. And that meant that they could send these chaps in dayglows along to say, we only allow you to do, what should we say, consumer-friendly activities in this space now. You can buy, you can nibble, you can hobnob. You can't sleep, you can't shut your eyes, you can't say anything political or religious. So not very common law. But that Guardian investigation of who owns London is very shocking, particularly the quotations they've managed to get of security guards saying, I'll do whatever the Arab owners of London tell me to do in this space. They call it now pseudo-public space, or the acronym for it is POPS, privately owned public spaces. The point is that the rules for what you can do there are private rules, and there's a map of how many of these places there are known to be in London. There's more all the time popping up. But you don't discover what's forbidden unless you have the misfortune to be homeless or indeed to be driven to make a speech or an appeal to somebody in one of these areas. Ultimately, the question of who owns London or any of our major municipal areas in the country is the banking and the insurance industries, which I think is why they've parachuted someone in like Nick Timothy to be Theresa May's aides, full name Nicholas James Timothy. Very odd that he claims to be the son of a steelworker from Erdington, a middle-class dormitory town for Birmingham. Nobody can find out who his mother is. He's appointed somebody called Michelle Mullin to manage his ancestral data online. And he was picked straight out of Sheffield University's political course to be the political advisor for the Conservatives, then to do the same industry-wide political advisory roles for the Association of British Insurers, and before that, the Corporation of London. So really spotted very early on to be a front man for very serious financial interests, probably because of what he was prepared to do. And he may have been, perhaps, shall we say, more highborn than he would care to let on. So anything people can find out about him is well worth it. Go to Guido Fawkes's page, Order, Order, and have a look at the footage of him being tackled last year when it turned out that he had personally written the script for how to stop Farage getting a seat in South Thanet. And he was tackled there in Westminster and just very arrogantly ignored in that video. You can see of the journalist, he very much ignored the man asking, why have you basically taken over the strategy to stop Farage getting a seat? I think a very questionable man indeed, and described in The Spectator and in Isabel Hardman interview by one of her sources, a colleague of his, as somebody who has an almost frightening degree of influence over Theresa May. So I think, Brian and Mike, we're seeing these characters coming out of the woodwork. They increasingly, or their foreign shells, own London and the country privately, and they wish to steer the country in certain directions. So they go out of university into the banks, then into the political parties, and then, as we see with Nick Timothy, onto the schools to educate the next generation.
Yep.
Indeed, and we will certainly spend more time having a look at the Tory party children and that angle of outside influence. But of course, if we're talking banking huge amounts of money, we've got to be talking defence and defence procurement and what the military are doing. Russia Today is reporting this one, that the US Navy has launched construction of a maritime operations centre in Ukraine, which apparently serves as a major planning and operation hub during military exercises. So we're supposed to believe, Mike, that this investment is, well, it's only really there if we're doing exercises. I don't think so. There's a young lieutenant here who's the officer in charge of the detachment that's doing the building. He says our ability to maximise European reassurance initiatives in Ukraine holds strategic importance and ultimately improve host nation defence capacity and infrastructure, strengthen relations and increase bilateral training capabilities. Here's the bilateral come in. So what is this? Well, America's already got 700 odd bases around the world, so they've got another one coming on here. And of course, this is right on the border. This is highly inflammatory for the Russians. So we'll bring in this, which Alex, I believe you found this very, very interesting map. What have we got here? Well, if you have a look on the left-hand side, the colour scale is indicating who would fight for their country. So the bottom towards the red colours, people not really interested. The yellow arrow is somewhere break even, 50% of a population would, 50% wouldn't. And then as you come above that, the greater part of a population would fight for their country. What can we see? Well, we can see that Europe's in a bit of a mess. Germany's very, very low, as indeed Japan is. That was part of the survey, obviously, in another part of the globe. But what has the European Union succeeded in doing? Well, it seems suppressing all of that national pride. So nobody's going to fight for their country. Now, before people say, well, who would, we have to remember that this is not just a question of saying who would fight. It's giving us an indication of who actually believes in their country. That's the background to it. A total of 62,398 people interviewed globally. What's your take on those results, Alex?
Well, I think, Brian, and we were discussing this in the Balkans episode, which will go up for members tomorrow, all being well. What it's done is, as the EU and NATO, which are increasingly the same thing, or the EU supplanting NATO, have ploughed a line deep into the southeast of Europe in the Balkans, this has caused the peoples there, particularly the non-Indo-European peoples who have always got a much more ethnically homogeneous history, the Finns, the Estonians, the Hungarians, the Turks above all. It's prompted them to say, well, we really are going to have to defend ourselves here. And Ukraine as well has got a high figure, but that's because the Western Ukrainians would fight for their version of Ukraine and the Eastern ones for their Russian-speaking enclave. So wherever the EU and NATO have gone, They have particularly, with decaying from the centre, like a potato rotting as it gives rise to new tubers, the Germans and the Benelux at the centre have got this attitude that, well, lesser peoples at the periphery of Europe will do the dirty work for us. We're just here to make the money. And the effect of this is a ripple. And so the greatest effect is at the edges, where the periphery of Europe, particularly the east and the southeast of Europe, people are increasingly bellicose. And so at the very least, you get the rhetoric of Viktor Orban and Beata Szydło in Hungary and Poland, respectively, all stoked by the EU and NATO.
The image of the European Union being a rotten potato will stay with me.
Okay, we're going to end on this one then. This is from 21st Century Wire. The headline is Syria, the SAA battle for liberation of Jobar and Antarma, Damascus from Nusra Front occupation. Vanessa Bealey posted this this morning. Now, Vanessa's been in Syria for the last several weeks. She just, I believe, has left today. She's making the point that al-Nusra and so on. She mentioned this a number of weeks ago on the UK column that the various tunnels and underground bunkers in Damascus make it very difficult to get rid of certain terrorist factions, including al-Nusra, from the old city of Damascus. So she's talking about that. But the point that I wanted to highlight was that a day or two ago, she was visiting one of the main installations for the real Syria civil defence. This is not the White Helmets. This is the real fire brigade and civil defence in Damascus. And while she was there, that place was being mortared from some of these insurgents still around and subject to some sniper fire as well while she was there. So, of course, who were these mortars being aimed at? The real Syria civil defence. This is the people that are actually doing the job in Damascus of putting out fires and helping people that have been injured as a result of insurgent activity. And she just wanted me to highlight this guy who was an SAA officer, Rafe, you'll have to excuse my pronunciation, Rafe Wajij al-Sheli. Unfortunately, he passed away soon after this this video was taken.
Is this the man centre in the...
That's right, the man centre in this photograph, because he was fatally injured. In fact, was carrying the injury as he was talking to these guys. But he appears to have passed away soon after this this photograph was taken. So this was all taking place while she's there. Clearly, still problems even in Damascus in Syria. But you know, the key point here is it is the real peacekeepers that are there that are being subject to most of the continuing terrorist activity.
Yeah. Alex, just 30 seconds to close on that or any other subject.
Well, I think, Brian, this just shows the necessity of funding independent researchers and journalists. Vanessa Bealey, I think, is the one I would praise above all as absolutely worth it. Donations and support and messages of encouragement, but UK Column and 20th Century Wire, 21st Century Wire, beg your pardon, very much need these donations. And every time we say this, we get people posting under YouTube saying, you're just in it for the money. I assure you we're not. We have all of us better things to be doing, well, not better things, more lucrative things to be doing with our time as formerly professional men in other fields. But we're driven to do this. And Vanessa, above all, she puts her life on the line for it. So now is the time, if ever, to fund us with whatever you can. And we shouldn't be abashed about saying it.
Alex, well, thank you very much for saying that. We'll just add, of course, that as we see the government conjuring up draconian methods to suppress any form of independent media, what does that prove? Well, it proves that the work that we are all doing, many other people across the world, is starting to have an effect. And if we continue to stoke that, we can put a stop to what's happening. So we'll end on a positive note and, of course, the image of the European Union being a rotting potato. And we'll say thanks very much for joining us. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye.